Listen online or download from the RN website.
Welcome to Booksmart Daily on RN. I'm Michael Cathcart. Nice to be with you today on the program Erotica, Politics, Ghostly Cities and Some Decidedly Mixed Identities. This is the story of a love affair with China, or rather about two such love affairs. Writers Amy Tan and Linda Javen on their personal and literary relationships with the Middle Kingdom. You might have heard a conversation I had with Amy Tan here on the show a fortnight ago. She was talking about her latest novel, The Valley of Amazement, and some pretty extraordinary run-ins she had with her mother. I also spoke to Sydney writer and translator Linda Javen about her novel too. So what happens when you bring these two very feisty women together? Let's find out. They're on stage at the Sydney Writers Festival with Kate Evans.
Hello and welcome to this session at the Sydney Writers' Festival and on ABC RN, A Love Affair with China with writers Amy Tan and Linda Javen. I'm Kate Evans. Both of these women write in their latest novels about women, power, sex, translation and moving between cultures. Both deal with social transformation, rebellion and identity. China's past is at stake in both Amy's Valley of Amazement and Linda's The Empress Lover. But I'm really looking forward to hearing about the differences between your versions of China too. So hello and how lovely to be here with both of you.
It's lovely to be here.
Great to be here.
So I'm going to focus on your latest novels, but shamelessly push you to reflect on your personal experiences of China, as well as your literary versions of the place. So I'd like to ask each of you to introduce us to the particular place of your latest novel, or the main cities rather, because you both do venture outwards, because one of you does Shanghai, the other Beijing. So Linda, those differences are significant, aren't they, in how we imagine China, thinking about cities like Beijing and Shanghai?
Yes, I think so. And China divides far more strongly along the Shanghai versus Beijing lines than Australia on Sydney versus Melbourne. Far, far more sharply. And one of the key differences is that people who are attracted to Beijing, and this includes Chinese people, tend to be more attracted to the essence of China, Chinese history, that has to do with not just Han culture, but also the mix of Mongolian and invader cultures from the north. And Shanghai has its colonial background, and people, foreigners, like to see themselves reflected in the buildings. I keep thinking, I'm a Beijing person, obviously, but Shanghai. I keep thinking, like, why do you go on about the Bund and it looking like sort of like Paris, when it's not Paris? Why not go to Paris? Why not go to Beijing and really be in China? You know, so that's the essence of it. And I love Beijing.
Well, let's talk about which Beijing you're talking about, though, because in this novel, you're talking about contemporary Beijing, the Beijing of 25 years ago, and the Beijing of the 1940s. How much is the 40s version still felt in contemporary Beijing? How much can you still find the 1940s version of Beijing?
1940s Beijing has been quite wiped out. I mean, let's be frank about it. A lot of the wonderful aspects of Beijing's culture, its hutongs, its houses, all gone. So the culture that one of my characters, who's an historical person called Edmund Backhouse, would have known, Edmund Backhouse would come back to contemporary Beijing and think it was Shanghai. You know, he would have no idea where he was, with the exception of certain pockets. 25 years ago, the difference between then and now, there's also the physical difference, but it's a real, it's an ambient difference as well. It's a difference in what people are questing for, what people are talking about, what people want. It's the worlds within China, the Chinese worlds within the city have shifted as well.
So, Amy Tan, although you do take us into regional China in The Valley of Amazement, and I hope we can get to that a bit later, the city of Shanghai, what makes it so interesting to you, particularly in the early part of the 20th century?
It's a very personal place for me. My family is from Shanghai. My mother was born there, but also my grandmother lived there, and during the 20th century, She has. She had a life that is now, to me, kind of a mystery, in which she might have not been the old-fashioned traditional woman I thought she was, but actually a courtesan before she became a concubine to a very rich man. It was also a period of intense foreign trade, the upsurge of foreign trade, and a lot of interaction between the Western world and Chinese entrepreneurs who didn't have a lot of contact socially. Most of the people in my family have had some role in foreign trade. They had businesses dealing with that. So that also is very interesting to me.
So Shanghai is a cosmopolitan city and a trading port, as you say, but there was also a city within the city of Shanghai.
Yes, the international settlement.
The international. Can you explain that?
It was like an enclave within Shanghai, and it was, a lot of people think that the exclusive part of Shanghai was the French concession, but it really was the international settlement, and that is where a lot of the Westerners lived. Including Australians, the Brits, the Americans, and also the Japanese among the foreigners there, and the Chinese also lived there, and the courtesan houses were there because they were not under the same strictures that they might have been in the old city, the old Chinese city, and that little settlement area also had its own laws that were governed by the Brits. And they had their police that were mostly, they were Sikhs. And they had different rules. If you were a Chinese person, you broke the law, you end up in an American court, for example. And they would try you by their rules.
So ostensibly, we have the two of you writing about very different cities, very different places in China. But the connections come thick and fast. So, Linda, you also have a city within a city in Beijing, in that you're exploring the imperial world. Can you explain that?
The imperial world, Beijing is a city of three, traditionally, of three concentric walls. And the outer wall was the city wall, which was only finally destroyed in the 1960s. It's terribly sad. It was actually one of the last great medieval walled cities in the world. And then within that was the imperial district, and that would enclose the palace, the Forbidden City, which was very, restricted. There was the front part for imperial business, the back part where the emperor lived and so on. But around that were all the provisioners to the palace, the noblemen, their families. So there were really... Beijing is a city of walls, and it's a city of inner circles. And the closer you go inside, even within the Forbidden City, there's the walls around the back section, which is where all the private stuff happened, the emperor's women and, the places of union, etc.
Or the empress.
Or the empress. So, mm-hmm. Yes, so there was, in my book, I explore one of the most potently controversial and interesting characters from recent Chinese history, the Empress Dowager Cixi. She was a Manchu. They were an invading tribe who came and conquered the Ming Dynasty in 1644 and had a very long and prosperous dynasty that began to collapse in the 19th century as a result of the same sort of imperial incursions and pressures that created mm-hmm. the international settlement mm-hmm. that Amy writes so beautifully about. And so Cixi was this very strong character. She was a woman. She wasn't allowed to be the emperor, but she was the regent, the person who ruled on behalf of her son. And then her son died, and then she kind of maneuvered her nephew onto the throne, and she ruled on behalf of him. She was very powerful, and of course she incited all sorts of jealousies, all sorts of rumors. Was she sexually wild? Was she not? And in 1944, an Englishman called Backhouse, who was a polyglot scholar, kind of a reserved gentleman, very shy, people didn't know him that well, he left behind two memoirs. And one of these memoirs was called Decadence Manchu, and it's the most erotic, crazy, out there thing you will ever read in your life, I promise you. And I write erotica, I read a lot of erotica. This kills it. And he is a character in my fiction because he imagined that he had entree into, as many people do, we all want to have entree into the inner circle, wherever we are, don't we? We want to be part of the inner thing. And he imagined himself into the boudoir of the Empress Dowager Cixi.
Hold that thought. We'll get back to Backhouse, and I promise we'll get back to the sex. So we talked about the international prefecture as a city within a city, but you construct a whole other contained world in Shanghai, and that's the world of the concubine.
So the world of the courtesan.
The courtesan.
Yes, right, right.
So explain how you came to think about that world and how you came to enter it imaginatively.
I always thought of that as one of the clichés of Shanghai, the courtesans, you know, the exotic, erotic world of Sin City. But I had a shock when I saw that I had a favorite photo of my grandmother, a very beautiful photo of her. And I was doing research on Shanghai, and in this book, I came across a photo of 10 women. They were called the 10 Beauties of Shanghai. 5 of them were wearing an outfit identical to what my grandmother was wearing, and they were courtesans. So this, of course, led me to sit back and say, okay, my old-fashioned grandmother was not necessarily, you know, a quiet woman who stayed at home. It didn't mean that she was out there being a very sexual person and decided to become a courtesan. There is a history of what happened that might have led to that. I looked at all of this and I said, I need to go into that world. I need to know what might have been her life, because my grandmother obviously influenced my mother, and my mother had a great influence on me, my character, the way I see the world, my beliefs about things, my approach to life, my sense of trust in the world. And I have to believe that what she passed on to me is something she got from her mother. So I want to know who that woman was in the and if it was indeed that she was a courtesan living in a courtesan house, how would those circumstances have affected her approach to life, her attitudes?
I'm interested that you said, though, that you had to confront the clichés about the courtesan. And this is really a question to both of you, because you've got courtesans, empresses, you know, how much as writers did you have to confront sort of Orientalist ideas of women and sexuality and China? Were you working with those ideas or working against them?
Well, I wasn't working exactly against them, but I think that without any context, if I heard somebody just out of the blue saying, I'm going to write about a courtesan house, I think, oh, okay, well, it is a very highly charged, interesting area. I've had people in the past who said, why are you writing about concubines? You know, that this is the old-fashioned China, and you should get beyond that. And I think, well, just so happened that my grandmother was a concubine. And that she killed herself. So I am interested in knowing about that world. Because when you're talking about the women in your life, you have to know what the past history was and what they were up against, how they persisted, how they survived within that particular world. And so all of my writing is personally focused. You know, I'm writing for myself. And I'm sorry, I'm glad that you read my books, but I'm writing for me. because I find things in there, the questions that I want to ask, that relate to me. It's not that the characters are me, but the questions are.
And what about for you, Linda?
Yes, it's similar. The questions are very much ones that I want to answer. And one of the things that's always perplexed me you know, I'm not Chinese and I've spent so much of my life in China, and the relationship of, in particular, not just the foreigner to China, but the female foreigner to China, because the male foreigner has all sorts of cliches ready-made for him, including the courtesan.
Yeah.
And the female doesn't. And also the whole premise of Orientalism, you know, where you have the conception of the Orient, which in Said's case he meant the Middle East, but we obviously, it totally includes places like China, this fantasy of this, you know, soft and willing and open, you know, this gentle, mysterious, gentle land, you know, that's ready for conquering by the Western virile male. And I want to look at something opposite. And the thing about Backhouse and the Empress Dowager that's interesting, you know, his memoir, as far as I'm concerned, it's, some people believe it, I think it's fantasy, but what's fascinating is that he's gay, by the way, and most of the stuff in there is gay fantasy erotica, but he has the Empress Dowager take him up the, I don't know if I can say this, anyway, you'll have to read the book to find out exactly, but he's certainly the one who's being taken, shall we say. And so what happens is he sort of inverts that kind of Orientalist fantasy. And I wanted to relate that and think about who is Backhouse's heir, like who, because he was also a scam artist and a forger and a fantasist. And I often think that novelists are all forgers and scam artists and fantasists. I mean, you know, this is what we do for a living and we get away with it. Which is pretty good. Thank you all so much. But, you know, this is, and I wanted to explore that notion. I also wanted to explore the notion of the idea of the male, the Chinese male and the Western female. So invert some of those cliches and examine them. And I thought that the Empress and Backhouse was a nice starting point for many reasons.
And so, I mean, you have a history of writing very playfully about sex and erotica, but you're suggesting that you didn't have to go too far in being playful with this historical visions of sex.
With Backhouse, I had to go nowhere but decadence Manchu. You know? Seriously, my original conception for this novel was a different one. It's taken me 5 years to write. And I was originally going to go more straight into Backhouse and the Empress Dowager, and I realized that nothing I could possibly write could outdo what Backhouse has already written. So I thought, I'm going to bring him in and bring his fantasies in. And I mean, this is a terrible thing to do, but I actually have end notes here, so you know exactly what I have taken from his exact writing.
I have to say, you know, when I was reading Linda's book, first I was really amazed at how much of the history and the culture and everything she knew. But suddenly I get to this part, and I would read this sexual part, and I would go, now, to you radio listeners, imagine my jaw dropping really wide. I mean, that Backhouse guy, whoa, yeah.
He was something.
Yeah.
I mean, mind you,
to find that character. Oh,
he's great. He really is very great. But I mean, mind you, for sexiness, there is this entire thing in Amy's novel in which the courtesan is being instructed in the ways of the courtesan, and I'm like, wow, that's hot.
Based on research.
Well, tell us more about that, because the way that you write about sex is really interesting, because you do have the playful, erotic side of it, and then there are whole sections that are also about cruelty and violence tied up with the lives of these women as well.
I was hesitant to write about the sex because, of course, I'm imagining my grandmother, and it just seems that's unseemly, you know? You just, no, sorry, grandma. So I had to have this separate chapter in which this older courtesan provides the instruction of what a courtesan would do. And it includes the kind of things that happen with a virgin courtesan and the selling of the virginity and, you know, raising the price and things like that. Pretty much matter of fact in many ways. She would tell her these clues about what you do as a business technique as much as a sexual technique. There were things that have to do with clothing and how to do a scam at the jewelry store or how to win more affection, in other words, more of a stipend from a donor, a patron. And all of this I got out of scholarly research. The one thing I could not find, however, in the scholarly research, and the scholars also acknowledge they could not find this, are the actual things that took place behind the boudoir door. And so I had to turn to a classic, which I know you have read, Jinping Mei. The Plum and the Golden Vase, and they have many other names, which is, you know, if you read it in the expurgated version, which means they took out all the literary allusions and made it just pornographic, that has a lot of sex in there, and a lot of it is sadistic. It's sadism, wouldn't you say? It's a sadistic kind of... And a lot of the material that I read that had to do with sex was sadistic. And I felt that if this was the kind of sex that was being described in these novels that were very appealing to people at the time, that probably some of this had gone on as well in the courtesan houses. And I felt pretty comfortable that I could put that in there as part of it.
Now, Linda, you were saying that you do read erotica. I wonder then if reading that historical piece of erotica that you're talking about, if there's something about reading it in Mandarin and reading it in English. Are there sort of stylistic or literary ways or traditions of writing erotica in China?
The novel that Amy's referring to, Jinping Mei, is not only the one of the two classic and the most important classic Chinese erotic novel. It was written in the Ming Dynasty, but it's also considered by many people to be the most perfect piece of Chinese literature ever written. The literary bits that get excised so you can get straight to the dirty bits are actually the best bits. You know, it's amazing. And the dirty bits are very literary. Mm-hmm. So this is something that there is this amazing tradition of eroticism that runs underneath the official Chinese, what was meant for centuries, the official Chinese ideology of Confucianism, which has a slightly different emphasis to it. It's more about order, and Jinping Mei is all disorder. But Jinping Mei, the whole Chinese conception of sexual relations has to do with order and breaking order, because Jinping Mei was written in response to another Ming Dynasty classic called Water Margins, or Outlaws of the Marsh. And that had several chapters in which the character, who's the lead character of Jinping Mei, is introduced. And it's a morality tale. And in this one, she's killed. But then Jinping Mei imagines, what if she wasn't killed? And goes on and creates an alternative universe, which is also an alternative universe to the strict moral code of Water Margins.
Mm-hmm. At the Sydney Writers' Festival and on ABC RN, we're with writers Amy Tan and Linda Javen, and I'd like to return now to your latest novels. Now, Amy, in The Valley of Amazement, one of your central characters is Violet, with a white mother and a Chinese father. Why choose her as one of your protagonists?
One of my overriding questions that I look at in every single novel is this question of identity, self-identity. A lot of people think that I'm writing about mothers and daughters, but it really is included in that whole question of who we are. And obviously, I look Chinese. My race is Chinese. I was raised by a Chinese family, but I was also raised in the United States. And so there's a part of me, my attitudes, my assumptions are very American. And I wanted to have that dichotomy in a girl who recognizes also that her sense of self depends a great deal on which side of this, you know, race coin she lands on. She lives in the international settlement, and if she's white, she has a lot of privilege, and she's one of the people who looks down on the Chinese people. She would talk in pidgin to any Chinese person, even if that person had been educated at Oxford. So certainly she doesn't want to be considered one of those people she looks down upon. I had a problem when I was a young kid, thinking that I hated my Chinese side, and I thought that maybe I had landed in the wrong family. You know, down when I was born, I went down the wrong chute, you know, and came out with this Chinese family, you know, talking Chinese. And so it was is with that sense that I wanted to look at who we are in terms of our circumstances. If you could have a plain slate, who would we be? Well, there is no plain slate. So how do you start taking apart the different factors that have added up to who we are?
So, Linda Javen, in The Empress Lover, your central character is Linny, with a white mother and a Chinese father. Why choose her as your protagonist?
Well, we don't actually know. The thing about Linny is that she's self-created. She looks in the mirror. She has no idea who her father was. There's circumstances about her family. Her mother died, shortly after she was born, and the father was always a mystery. So as she grows up, she creates different identities, and she doesn't settle on Chinese right away. But later, she does decide this. And she's somebody who's constantly creating her own identity. Who is she the heir of? Who is she related to? What group of people? And I think that's a way of me exploring, I explore questions of identity as well. And I did that in a novel called Infernal Optimist, in which I speak through the voice of a Turkish-born, Western suburbs-raised, Muslim, small-time Krim, you know, and... I mean, really, you know, I love the thought of who we are and how we create ourselves. And he considered himself completely Australian. Mm-hmm. And I was brought up in the States. I spent very important 9-10 years in China and Taiwan and Hong Kong. And now I live here, but I go back to China all the time. And a lot of formative experiences for me took place in China, really, really important experiences. And I went to China at first. I went to Taiwan to study, to continue my study of Chinese after university. And I wanted to be Chinese. So unlike Amy, I was like, I'm really Chinese. You know, I went down the wrong chute the other way. And so I would hang out with Chinese people and think, oh my God, I'm so good. I haven't spoken English for a month. And then a foreigner would walk into a room and I'd be like, ew, get me away. They're spoiling the, you know, there's actually a Chinese phrase, sha fen feng jiang, which is to kill the landscape. Mm-hmm. You know, I actually had that feeling for a long time. So it is that thing of self-creating identity. And of course, on my part, it's completely absurd.
So you're both then writing about China, but is it your China, or do you always then imagine yourselves as outsiders?
That's a good question. I mean, I think this is very much my China. There is a lot of my personal life in this, even though it's not autobiographical, but it's a China that I know so intimately. What was the rest of the question?
I guess where you see yourself in relation
but
to China.
But I am an outsider, so I don't think I'm Chinese anymore, but I do have these experiences which can be really weird. Like the other day, I was March, I was driving with a friend. He was driving me to another friend's house near the Great Wall. And we're driving along, he's Chinese, and we speak in Chinese, and I don't know him that well, and we're exchanging stories. And he asked me something, and I tell him a story about an old boyfriend. And he goes, oh, where was he from? And I said, oh, he was Australian. And he goes, oh, you went out with a foreigner. And then he kind of caught himself, and he looked at me, and I looked at him, and we both burst out laughing. But those slippages, because, and that often happens, like Chinese people will say, oh God, you know, should we invite so-and-so? And like, oh no, they've got some foreigners with them, you know?
Yeah.
How tiresome, we don't have to, you know. But so there is this weird slippage, and you can't quite explain it, and I think I've just relaxed with it now.
Mm-hmm. And what about you, Amy? Do you see yourself, how do you see yourself in relation to China then?
I think of China as being the China of my parents. You know, and at the same time, I belong to that China just as I belong to my parents. I'm an American visiting there in my mind often, and I have a view in my fiction that often has that perspective, an American's perspective overlaid the Chinese one. So the influences are there. But I also, when I go to China, I feel very comfortable very quickly. Maybe it's because China has changed so much that the whole style of living there is not dramatically different. I like to tell people that the most modern hotel I've stayed in recent years is in China, in Beijing, opposite house.
Oh,
the airports, everything, the most this, the most that, the most modern high-tech hair salon is in Beijing. So it's there's not this disconnect when I get there in those kind of comforts. But what makes it my China is the habits of the family. And I settle right in. And that's when I realize that a country is also your family. And when I'm there and the habits are the same and the things that they say to me are the same, and that it's not particular to my family, but it's particular to people in China, then I realize I do belong to that country that shaped my family.
And if I can just add something, for me, it's like if I just stay here for too long and don't go back to China, I begin to feel slightly misunderstood or something. I feel like I can't. Words in Chinese, phrases in Chinese constantly pop into my head and come out my mouth when I'm not even, I could be talking about something that has nothing to do with China, but there's this Chinese expression that it says something perfectly and it just comes into my head, and or a joke that I want to share. And I have, there's an instant messaging thing, which is kind of a social media. You can have little groups of friends communicating. And I've got a little group of my closest friends in China, and I'll just go, and I'll say, what's the latest joke? Tell me a joke, you know, and they'll tell me a joke. Or when we communicate instantly, where are you? Here I am, you know, and and I have to feel connected that way. It's funny.
There is one terribly funny section in your book, though, where you talk about perceptions of language and speaking Chinese. And you've got one character who speaks Mandarin very well and is always told by locals, oh, you speak Chinese well. And apparently he simply responds by saying, are you taking the piss?
Yeah. And that's actually in China. You go, and if you don't speak Chinese very well, you don't speak Chinese at all, and you just venture a ni hao. Every single Chinese person you meet will say, wow, you speak Chinese so well. Oh my God, look at you using chopsticks. It's so good. You know, and you know that means, God, you don't speak any Chinese. You know, you're barely holding on to those sticks, you know. And so it's funny, when somebody will say that to me, I actually turn around and I go, you're taking the piss? You know, ma renma, which is the thing that was, ma renma, which is you cursing me. Yeah. And that is the only correct response. People go, oh, you know. Because in fact, when you meet somebody and that never comes up, you're just a person, that's when you know it's seamless.
You speak so well. Actually, I went from ni hao ma, you know, and you speak so well, to my cousin's telling me at dinner, we used to be afraid to have dinner with you because it was so awkward. You couldn't say anything. And now we can actually have a conversation.
So you couldn't speak Mandarin?
I didn't.
Well?
You know, I grew up in a family that spoke Chinese, but I was not forced to speak it as a child because they mistakenly believed that if I grew up speaking Chinese, my English would suffer. And so I understood Chinese. I would hear it, especially when I was being criticized, which did not make me motivated to want to learn more Chinese. But I ended up, when I went to China, having to listen to Chinese constantly because my sisters did not speak English. And the other relatives that I was with did not. And so listening to this all the time and slowly being forced to speak, forced in a good way, I really did want to regain the Chinese. And I do believe that I spoke some when I was a kid. Gradually I was able to feel comfortable and just think in Chinese. And my Chinese is never going to be as good as Linda's. I mean, she is a scholar of Chinese, and she reads and writes and everything in Chinese. But, you know, what's sufficient to me is being able to talk to my family. And that's all I need. Someday I will leave my dogs for 3 months and actually stay in China for 3 months and really improve. I'm going to take Linda with me.
Yay! can I just say that I speak to my mother all the time, my 84-year-old mother back in the States, and I'm like, oh, Writers Festival coming up. And then I tell her, I met Irvine Welsh the other night. She's like, who? You know, and then it can't impress her. I said, I'm going to be on stage with Amy Tan. Oh, my God.
Now, Amy Tan, the other city in this book, though, and of course there are other sites as well, but the powerful other city, which it seems to me is connected to a sort of way of imagining China, is San Francisco. And so I'm curious about thinking about the relationship of diaspora communities to China and that experience of understanding Chinese and not necessarily being able to speak it is certainly part of it. But is that why San Francisco is a presence in this book?
San Francisco is my hometown, basically. I was born in the Bay Area in Oakland and lived in San Francisco for 30 years. So I'm very rooted there. It's also the place that my parents went to when they immigrated from Shanghai to the United States, and they lived in San Francisco for a while. So I'm very familiar with those parts of the city historically from a certain period. But I wanted to go in this novel a different direction with one of the characters, and it's to go from San Francisco to China. So it's a reverse immigration, so to speak. Chinese parents coming to the United States, they're immigrants here, but this white woman, this American woman going there, now being the foreigner, now having lost her sense of self, being there, being unable to speak a language, unable to understand any of the customs and why she can't use American Yankee ingenuity to get what she wants. It's simply not going to work. And she doesn't understand that. So it's a loss of many different things, and I wanted to see it from the other side, because by doing that, I think I also understand the other way even more, understanding what is the Chinese way of thinking, what is inalterable, and what somebody would not be able to understand or feel when they're, if they had not lived in that world and had not known anything about it. Lulu, the character I'm talking about, the American woman, she ends up creating her own world within that world of the international settlement. She does use Yankee ingenuity, but she had to create a different world to do that.
Now, Linda, when we were talking about Beijing, we ended up talking more about 1940s Beijing than contemporary Beijing. And one of the really striking things about your novel is the way in which it's haunted by the events of Tiananmen Square. So as a place, it's almost, it is a sort of the ghostly site of the novel. Can you talk about that? Is that how you feel still when you go to Beijing?
It's funny. I went to Beijing once, a friend from Sydney who'd never been there, and when we got to Tiananmen, he was just like, oh, this is where the blood flowed and all this stuff. Those events affected me so hugely. I was in Shanghai the night when the firing started, flew into Beijing the next morning. I was in Beijing on June the 4th, heard the gunfire, there was a corpse under our window. And friends of mine were deeply, deeply affected. It was a very important part of my life. But I've also gone back there now for 25 years. This is the 25th anniversary of those events. And so obviously every place gets layered up with more memories and more things. And that will never disappear. That will never disappear. And it's an important thing. But I was like, oh, come on, Tiananmen's, like, this is also, a place where other things happen. I kind of wanted to switch the off switch, also partly because he hadn't been there. And it was a bit unfair of me, perhaps, but I don't know exactly why I got so annoyed. But I think we all carry these layers, and cities have many layers. And there's certain, I'm very attached to the 80s in China. I think, in a way, everyone's attached to places of their youth. You know, I spent my 20s and my 30s, a lot of my 20s and my 30s in Beijing. And that time of Beijing was a time of great opening. The Cultural Revolution was over. People were desperate for contact with the outside world, for cultural knowledge, for self-expression. It was very special. And a lot of the book does reflect back on that. That's very important to my character. That time when everything was hopeful. And in a way, it's anyone's youth. And in a way, it's very specific to Beijing. But it didn't end well.
Well, and there is a sense in the novel of a disquiet with the erasure of the events of Tiananmen Square and the official erasure of the events.
And that is one of the things that one struggles with, when you're in China, because there is so many things that have gone on there, and official histories acknowledge some of them and then just wipe out the rest. And there are these historical memories, because Beijing is a city. I also have a new book, Beijing, and I had to write a history in 35,000 words of Beijing from 700,000 years ago when the Peking man lived. There was urban settlements in this place from 3,500 years ago. So Beijing is overladen with histories of massacres and bloodshed and corruption and celebration and so many different things. And I think you try to come to terms with what is in your own past and what strikes you. But it is very concerning to me how some memories are officially suppressed and how some memories we suppress because they're too traumatic, and then how we remember them.
Well, and Amy, there's certainly plenty of bloodshed and rebellion and other things going on in Shanghai in your novel. But in terms of that complex, say, last century or so history of China, political history, is it easier for you to deal with that by using making historical work? I'm just wondering how you address the politics of China.
Well, you know, a lot of my family lives in Beijing, and I would go to Beijing quite often. And I was thinking of the events of Tiananmen Square. My uncle lived in Wuxi-Di, which is where, yes, Linda knows exactly where that is. Wuxi-Di, where a lot of the retired officials live. My uncle was the vice secretary of labor for all of China. And so I got a different perspective of that. I would be staying in his house for weeks listening to what I called party hits of the 50s, meaning communist tunes of patriotism. And I was supposed to go to the embassy once, and my family was so afraid I would do something that would get them in trouble. I had people say to me, all I want to do is live my life peacefully. I do not, you know, basically they did not want me to upset their life. And so I was left with this dilemma, not a very big one, when people came to me and said, you should be standing on the square, you should be doing something, standing in the middle of New York, denouncing the Chinese government. And I said, what are my responsibilities? To do this demonstration about China and the human rights, or to also be protective of my family that might be put in jail? No question. Be protective of my family. And I also think that my standing in the middle of a square denouncing China is not going to do a damn thing. It's not going to do a damn bit of good. And so I've had a lot of back and forth in my mind about what do you do, where do you stand on human rights, where do you stand on freedom of speech and all of that, and how you can make a difference. Having lived with my family in Beijing and other parts of China, I also am very keenly aware that there has been a change that's happened in the last 30, 40 years and today, and that is that the people who are now making a lot of money in this new middle class, wealthy class, they are not the youth who marched in Tiananmen Square and erected the Statue of Liberty. They are young people who also say, do not interfere with our country. We are doing quite well without you. Harkening back to the days of Chinese history, from the revolutions, the student rebellions of this period, this period, this period, and also looking back, I know this sounds really petty, but I think Chinese people will never forget the Versailles Treaty, in which China was taken away from them and handed to the Japanese. And that led to World War II. None of the conditions they asked for were granted to them. They will never forget that history. We have short memories. They have very long ones. And so what we're seeing now is the rise of a superpower economically and also in other areas. And we have to pay attention to what that history had done in looking at diplomacy now.
Well, it's interesting because when you said they lived in Wuxi-Di, of course, that was in 1989. A huge amount of the killings on the street
took in their
place
building,
right outside their building, and several
in
people
their building.
In their building got shot and killed while in their homes. Yeah. And so it's a very interesting thing because the Chinese people who lived through this, they know the score. They know what can be said, what the utility of saying things are. Some of them take great, brave risks. I mean, right now there is a huge roundup of writers and intellectuals going on in China today. There's always these roundups. But I mean, you have people like Liu Xiaobo, who's been in prison since 2009. He got the Nobel Peace Prize in 2010. By then, he still had to serve 10 years. Why? Because he was an author of Charter 08, something about democracy. So, you know, some people make these decisions and other people don't. And I think the important thing to come to grips with is somebody who doesn't live there, who is not a citizen, and who is not as vulnerable to the kind of penalties that will be imposed on people who are citizens, is do not judge. you know, try and understand why different people come to different kinds of accommodation. Some people do not accommodate. They stand up, they're counted, they go to prison, they take responsibility for, you know, strong action and principled action. Other people just go, I think I just want to have a good life and I just want to make some money. And you just go, right, I understand, you know, I'm not going to judge you. Mm-hmm. And I'm not going to try to tell you what to do because I am not, you know. What I do is sometimes people in China, especially younger people, they say, tell me about this and tell me about that. And I'll do that. I'll tell them what I know because they don't get access. One of the reasons for the kind of nationalism that Amy's talking about is the restriction within the press and the kind of encouragement in the education system of a certain kind of rah-rah nationalism. On the other hand, the Treaty of Versailles, 1919, absolutely crucial to how China sees itself today.
Mm-hmm. And with such a powerful point, I'm going to completely ignore the little fluffy section that I had down in front of me. And I think this would actually be a really good time to open up questions from the floor. And I know we won't get to all the questions that you would like, but there is a man right next to the that post right there. And so we'll just start over here.
My name is Brandon. Linda, in her presentation, mentioned that the outer wall of Beijing in 1960 had been broken down or demolished. Amy had mentioned that the most modern hotel she'd been in the world was in China. China, as alluded to by both speakers, has been a country that for a long time has been put upon by external forces. Linda referred to 1644... the invasion. They referred, of course, to the Opium Wars, which are a failure for China. The Boxer Revolution, another failure for China. The imposition of the concessions, a failure or embarrassment to China. The Japanese invasion and the rape of Nanjing, another failure for China. Do you think there's an attempt to remove some of the symbols and reminders of the old China, the embarrassing China, and replace it with a modern, perhaps a Western-defined identity?
If I can answer about Beijing, because I was just dealing with this in my book, the destruction of the walls of Beijing and the destruction of old Beijing, it was not a join the rest of the world. It was a Maoist plan to destroy history and tradition and to disrespect history and tradition. And it was with the advice of Soviet advisors who wanted to create an essentially a red square. That was the origin of Tiananmen Square. And so then later, the destruction of the traditional housing that's accelerated is greed, developer greed, and lack of, you know, proper historical, even though they say, oh, yes, we're protecting this for heritage, etc. It's so many different forces at work, and it's very complex. So, yes, there are certain pushes towards westernization, if you want to call it that, but I think it's more like global modernization. I mean, as Amy said, they far surpass. I mean, every time I go to the States, I'm like, why can't they have an airport half the size, half the efficiency and beauty of an airport in China? You know, it's like, America, come on, you know, raise your standards. It's a very complex thing, but it's not one simple narrative. Would you agree?
Yeah, and I also don't think that China is trying to take a Western model.
No.
It has, you know, modern, many modern aspects to it now that's very unlike the China many people might imagine. But I think they've gone beyond, you know, let's copy the West. Or if they have Western things, Western aesthetics, it does not mean that they have a Western mind. And that is a really crucial difference for people to remember. I think they still have a deep sense of pride in their history, Chinese people I know.
And so the
walls may be gone, but everybody always refers to, oh, that hotel or that really great hair salon that's over in Second Ring Road. Well, the rings refer to the former rings around the city, you
know.
And so
you,
yes, the wall,
place of
those are the walls, the different walls. You say, oh, Third Ring Road, you know where. So they're always, they're like ghost walls, but they're very present. They very much define the city.
And I suspect we could talk about ghost landscapes for the whole rest of the afternoon.
Yeah.
Perhaps I could just throw in another question here. Sorry.
A very short question. Has your work been available in China, and what has been the reception?
My work is not. because it's too racy, but I think there are political aspects as well. I was once asked to speak at the National Library of China on my book A Most Immoral Woman, which deals with a part of history they can deal with. It's 1904, etc. But they specifically asked me before I went, they said, do not discuss your, it had a lot of Tiananmen stuff, do not discuss your memoir Monkey and the Dragon.
Mm. And Amy, is
my
yours?
Books are translated there, and I'm always shocked to find that people who are Chinese have read this book. When I was growing up, my mother used to say, "You know nothing about being Chinese," you know. And so it's very great. I'm grateful when I have people say, "You've captured exactly what it's like to be," you know.
And even though you did say that your novels aren't all about mothers and daughters, there's a lot about mothers and daughters. There is a question over here.
Hello, my name's Dylan Stevens and I'm a student in the Southern Shire in Sydney. So I've seen a theatre production recently in Walsh Bay actually, and it described China as being the land of the contradiction. So there are many ideas that we've even learned about in this talk today, like the themes of order and disorder in Taoism and things like even in that... I've forgotten the name of it, but the old erotica novel. And even in, Amy, your book, The Joy Luck Club, the mother and daughter, the prevalent relationship even through this plight. I'm wondering how you think this idea of the land of the contradictions has affected the cultural landscape and therefore our relationship and our image of China.
I would say that we tend to think like that. Oh, you know, contradictions, that's one of the kind of cliché-ic ways of dealing with a place that we can't quite get, if you know what I mean. But the way I think of China personally is I think China has... What fascinates me is that China is and has everything. It has the worst of human nature and it has the best of human nature. It has the most beautiful things and the ugliest things. It has every extreme and every single thing you can find on this earth in one country. And that describes it more to me than simple contradictions, two ends of one stick. It's just everything. That's my own sense of it.
Is that description one that a Westerner gave, or is that self-described Chinese? Is that?
I'm not sure who wrote the play, but it had Chinese actors in it.
Uh-huh. I do think of China as being a land of contradictions because I think of myself as a person of being of contradictory thought all the time, meaning I might hold a thought that means that it should be preclude my having another thought, but it doesn't. And so what I think that is kind of a mindset in China I've come across in everyone I know that is called pragmatism. And pragmatism allows you to hold different thoughts that may appear to be contradictory. They may not occupy the same temporal space. And so that is pragmatism, a philosophy that encounters a force and melds itself whatever way is necessary. I do think that that is true with the government that you see, that you can have things that come down and openness, they declare it openness and you find that they actually have shut down the ability to watch some TV show that seems so innocuous, you know, and then why? Why have they done this? And you don't quite understand what that is, and to try and do it is completely frustrating. You don't know whether there's some money under the table so that, you know, some other show can be there, or whether it is a crackdown on expression, or whether they hated the show, or somebody didn't get a part in it. You know, you just never know, right?
Or it could be something like I heard yesterday from somebody who was involved in music stuff in Beijing. She said after Bjork played in China and said free Tibet at her concert,
yes.
After mm-hmm. that, all of the people involved in organizing international musical
yes.
events
mm-hmm.
were told to rewrite the contracts, even for people who were already contracted to come, and put in a clause that said they would definitely never, ever, ever say anything that was political in the course of their, you know, so it's a constant work in progress.
But here we are at the Sydney Writers Festival and on RN. I'm Kate Evans and you've been with writers Linda Javen and Amy Tan. Please do thank them.
Writers Amy Tan and Linda Javen on stage at the Sydney Writers Festival with Kate Evans. And do pop along to our website if you want to comment on today's story, or if you'd like to listen to any of our stories online, you can do that right there as well. Now, tomorrow on Books and Arts, I Want to Dance Better at Parties. It's a creative collaboration between choreographer Gideon Obajanik, who was the founder of Chunky Move, and filmmaker Matthew Bate. There's also some fashionable investigations at the National Gallery of Victoria and a novel about the so-called Malayan Emergency in the 1960s. Coming up, it's Bush Telly or Big Ideas if you're listening at night. I'm Michael Cathcart. This is RN. We're just coming up to news time. Bye-bye.